This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Many women of my generation were raised with the idea that we could do anything, be anything, and have it all. The have-it-all dream is proving a little bit more easily said than done. To be sure, though, there has been incredible progress. For example, when Susan Humphreys started graduate school in 1972, she was one of two women in her department. Today, women outnumber men in many science graduate programs. Somewhere along the line, though, many of those women disappear. At the top levels of science, men outnumber women by more than 2-1 in many fields. Later this hour, Susan Humphreys reflects on the changes she's seen in her 4 decades in Woods Hole and what it's like to be one of the women who's made it to the top. First, though, Ellen Capel is founder and president of the earth science communication firm GeoPros, and she's editor of the journal Oceanography, which recently published its second Women in Oceanography issue. She joins me now by phone. Ellen Capel, welcome to Living Lab.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, glad you could join us. Ellen, you started graduate school at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. You went on 9 research cruises in 5 years. You published a PhD thesis that remains relevant today, 35 years later, and had a mentor that you've described as, quote, excellent. And yet, shortly after graduate school, you decided to leave academic research. Why?
Well, the reasons certainly are a bit complex, but despite having such wonderful mentors at the time, I do think a lack of mentoring for me as a young woman contributed to it. I also found that, and I don't know if this is uniquely women-based, but for funding, you have to, you're constantly going out there and doing more and sometimes with less. And I think I found that a little overwhelming in my young years as a scientist.
Did you think that your departure from academic research would be permanent?
I certainly did not. I thought I was going to give myself a 2-year reprieve, do some management at where I ended up with the Ocean Drilling Program, and then dive right back into academia. But for me, as it turned out, I found that I really loved program management and helping the community get the job done. So while I did have some opportunities to go back, I decided not to.
Do you think that women disproportionately choose science-related, what we might call alternative careers, that when they leave part of this disappearing from academic research, that what perhaps women are doing is going to some of these other science-related jobs that are not the mainstream academic stream?
I think a lot of women, first of all, I don't like the word alternate career, and I know you used it a little bit hesitantly. I find what I do is very much the same sort of career. It's just not in academia. I think we are seeing a lot of women going to careers that use their scientific background but are not a faculty member at a research institution or at a university. So, we do career profiling to help graduate students. So this is in oceanography, to help graduate students look at careers outside of academia. And certainly the vast majority of the people that we have interviewed, and you are, we did a career profile of you recently.
Yes, you did.
Are women.
So, I was going to ask you about this. In 2010, you introduced this new feature in every issue of the journal Oceanography, where you include profiles of people who have pursued careers that, as you say, make use of their scientific training but are not academic research. Do you think that perhaps qualifies as almost a form of mentorship for women who are struggling to find where they might fit into science?
Precisely. It wasn't necessarily geared toward women, but the column started because there are a lot of graduate students who don't actually want an academic career, or they come into graduate school and after a few years realize, maybe I don't want to have an academic career that funding, whether it's funding is getting tight, and or they just don't see themselves any longer. And well, and frankly, there aren't enough jobs out in academia for all the graduate students out there. And so in talking at an ocean sciences meeting with a bunch of graduate students, they said, you know, our mentors at the universities really don't have a lot of knowledge about what kinds of other jobs are out there. So it was really geared towards both men and women, looking, you know, trying to see, you know, how do you go about looking for a job? What jobs are out there? And it's really been a hugely successful column. But as you've seen, if you look at all the people that we've done profiles for, it's the majority are women. And, you know, I do try to get men, and it's really a matter of people. It's harder for me to find people who have left academia than who are in academia, so I'm constantly asking people for referrals. And I get far fewer men.
Right. In case you're just joining us, we're talking about women in oceanography this hour. I'm talking right now with Ellen Capel, editor of the journal Oceanography. Ellen, in December, Oceanography published its second special Women in Oceanography issue. Why? What was the impetus to do that now?
Well, it was exactly 10 years since we did the first issue, which came out in March 2005. And in that time, a group of women, again, at another meeting, some of us were talking, saying, you know, kind of, well, it's been 10 years. So has there been progress? And there have been also some programs that NSF and other agencies have funded to help retain women in oceanography. And so we wanted to take another look and see, have these programs done anything? The part that I really enjoy is getting autobiographical sketches of women in oceanography and see, you know, what they're doing, how the women who contributed these sketches 10 years ago, what happened in those 10 years, were there continued obstacles, you know, what was going on, and then a whole new crop of women telling us their story.
As you say, the issue is largely first-person profiles, and we'll hear from one of the female scientists whose stories was included, Susan Humphreys, coming up. But were there common themes that jumped out at you? Obviously, this is anecdotal, people telling their stories, but you've got a fair number of these stories. Were there common themes that jumped out at you as you read these profiles?
Absolutely. I mean, the biggest common theme by far was the career-family balance. Everybody just does it a little bit differently, but just trying, how do you balance, and here, of course, it's generally an academic career or professional science career, with having children or even caring for aging parents.
I noticed the photos, the photo collage that's on the front of the issue. One of the things that struck me was the number of women that in those photos, this is a professional journal, and the pictures that they submitted are of them with their children, and you know, I think I'm seeing, perhaps if I go to people's websites, more men posting a photo of them with their children on their professional website. But it really struck me at the number of women that had their children in their photos with them.
Yes, I guess I hadn't really thought about that, but you're absolutely right. There are a lot of women who have their photos of their children.
Somehow wrapping their family life and their professional life together, maybe.
It is, and a lot of women, you know, their stories of taking their kids to the lab on the weekends or coming to meetings with them, and so by the time they're five, they already know how to, you know, pack their bags and roll their suitcases in the airports. So, you know, very much children, you know, are coming out and doing field work if they can, certainly not on research ships, but, you know, to the shoreline or something.
Now, you also looked at a lot of data about women in oceanography, what has and hasn't changed over the past decade in particular, found a mix of progress and lack thereof, I would say. What for you were some of the bright spots, some of the areas that showed real improvement or real change in the past 10 years?
Well, certainly women going out to sea doing field work is astonishing. You know, Susan Humphries has, you know, talked about, will be talking about how few women there were going to see. And even when I was a student in the early 1980s, I've been the only woman out on a research vessel. I had been out on ships where the first officers, you know, you're trying to get tell them which direction, course, the heading for the ship to go, and the speed, and they won't listen to you. So I think women now go to sea, go to the field. There aren't the barriers anymore, or fewer barriers, and you know, they don't have to worry about not being taken seriously, I think. And the younger women in their autobiographies, many of them feel like there isn't gender bias. They're not feeling gender bias anymore.
Hmm. Well, that's encouraging. What hasn't changed looking at the statistics, or what is perhaps slow to change in terms of women in oceanography?
Well, I think it's women, certainly women in oceanography, and it's also across the STEM fields. We looked at a couple of the articles in the Women in Oceanography issue, looked at the number of graduate students coming out in PhDs being awarded to women in oceanography. And in 2002, it was about 40% of all the doctoral degrees went to women. In 2012, it was 48%. So even if you look at 40% of the doctoral degrees more than a decade ago, and you look at the faculty at oceanographic institutions or institutions that give PhDs in oceanography, and you still find that it's the full professors are only 15%. The associate level, it's 30%. The assistant level, which is, you know, just the young tenure track people coming in, it's 40%. So it's still less than you would hope given the number of PhDs women are getting, but and it hasn't improved as much as we would like over the last decade. So that was very disappointing.
One thing that jumped out at me was that ocean drilling, I mean, this rate of attrition of women kind of disappearing from science careers varies from field to field. And there's always, I think, this idea, and also borne out in the data, that kind of the harder sciences, the physical sciences, engineering, mathematics, is where we see the greatest attrition and the fewest women. Looking within the disciplines in oceanography, ocean drilling jumped out as one where there's greater equality and perhaps greater opportunity for women to make it to these more senior levels. Any thoughts on why that might be?
Well, you know, in ocean drilling, you know, and Susan will can talk more to it, I think in the scientific parties, you'll see a lot of women going out to sea, and that's really great. I mean, when you go out on the ocean drilling vessel, you're out at sea for 2 months, so that means leaving, you know, making adjustments in your family life for being away at sea for 2 months. In ocean drilling, though, the level I think we're still disappointed, though, is being a chief scientist on one of those expeditions. And that's where you still have far fewer women than we would expect. But being part of the shipboard science party, I do think you're seeing, from what I understand, close to equity, if not equity.
Now, for the Women in Oceanography issue that you published, you mentioned that it kind of came out of a handful of women talking at a conference. It struck me that the steering committee was entirely women. As a mother of three boys, something that always kind of that I grapple with is this necessarily just a women's issue? Where are the men helping to shape gender equality, and what could men be doing? Was this by choice, an all-female steering committee? Are there men out there that you encounter that are trying to improve this situation?
Absolutely. And the articles that we have in the first part of the issue, the Women in Oceanography issue, are peer-reviewed, and we did have men as part of the peer-review process. And so so in that sense, they did come in on this. Now, I do think that the men are very much a part of the process, and a lot of the programs now, that whether it's institutional or mentoring, even the Empower, the mentoring physical women in physical oceanography, definitely have men as part of the program. A lot of the programs that would be put in, that could be put in place for gender equity, definitely benefit both men and women. Here, obviously, we're looking largely at how women have fared, but I think there is certainly acknowledgement in most of the articles that, you know, men will benefit and should be a part of the process, have to be a part of the process as well.
Ellen Capel, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ellen Capel is editor of the journal Oceanography, which recently ran an issue dedicated to telling the stories of women in oceanography and examining changes in women's professional status and opportunities over the past decade. Up next, an oceanographer who was one of just two women in her graduate school class reflects on what has and hasn't changed in the past four decades. We also want to hear from you. If you're a woman, how has gender inequity or discrimination shaped your career? If you're a man, do you see yourself having a role to play in creating a more equitable work environment? Our phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. More Living Lab after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Susan Humphreys is a senior scientist in the Department of Geology and Geophysics at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. She has chaired that department and served as vice president of marine facilities and operations for the institution. During that time, she oversaw the recent overhaul and upgrade of the submersible Alvin. But when Susan entered the MIT Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution Joint Program in Chemical Oceanography in 1972, she was one of just two women in her department. Susan Humphreys joins me now in our Woods Hole studio. Susan, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you for having me.
We also welcome you to join our conversation. Tell us how gender inequity or discrimination has shaped your career and what you're doing to change things. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. Susan Humphreys, when did you first become interested in science, particularly ocean science?
I was always interested in science when I was in school, and I came up through the British educational system. And at the age of 16 in that system, each student takes exams in pretty much every subject that they have taken through school. And after that, you then specialize in three subjects. And I'd always found science a little bit challenging, and I decided that I wanted to keep on challenging myself. And so I ended up taking physics, chemistry, and pure mathematics for 2 years in high school. And I was expected then to go on and apply to Oxford and Cambridge to go on in science. But there was something in the back of my mind that I really liked being out in the ocean, or in the field at least. And so rather than go on in pure science, I ended up going to university and taking environmental sciences, which in the late 60s was an extremely rare subject. There were only two universities in England that had a program. And I loved it. I took hydrology and meteorology and geology, really enjoyed it, and was not really certain what area I was going to go on in. And then during my last year at university, I took a program called Marine Geochemistry. And as I looked in the textbooks, I saw pictures of large research vessels and scientists out doing work in the oceans. And I thought, wow, what a great combination. I love the oceans. I would like to travel. And I like science. So why not put it all together? And so I applied to the MIT Woods Hole Joint Program. And I guess the rest is history.
Even today, you know, we constantly talk about, especially at that age of 16, that we see girls dropping out of math, that perhaps there's not the institutional support or societal support for girls to choose math and science as an interest, as a major, as a possible career path. Did you feel supported in that decision?
I think I did. I was at an all-girls school, which I think actually helped. There were only three of us in the physics class. Even at that time, I think girls in high school generally do tend to shy away from science. And of course, there wasn't as much learning by doing in those days as there is now. And I think that one of the great improvements has been inquiry-based and experiential-based learning. And I think that's really helping improve the situation.
You started graduate school, as you said, here in Woods Hole. Two women in your department. And we hear so much today, women in science, careers in general, about how important it is to have a peer network for support, how important it is to have mentors who share your values and perhaps even look like you as a way of, supporting diversity in the workplace. Where did you turn for support and inspiration as a graduate student when you're in such a distinct minority?
Yeah, we had no, there were no scientists in the department who were women at the time when I first came. And the other woman actually was an entering graduate student with me in the same year. In general, I think that because of that, that the students across the institution formed a fairly close network, and we looked to each other for peer support. In terms of mentoring, I think mentoring was nowhere near as recognized as it is today as an important function. Clearly, every student had an advisor, and those advisors were responsible for ensuring you got the necessary training. But in terms of mentoring from the perspective of how you're planning out your career and your future directions, that was really lacking. And I think in general, we tended to talk to each other as graduate students and as peers as to how was the best way to move forward.
I mean, when you say you formed a tight-knit group of students across the different departments, you mean the female students? Or what were the relationships like with the male graduate students? Was it a supportive environment?
It was, absolutely. And because there were so few women students, the network tended to be dominated by men. And really, even at that time, it was very much a cohesive group of people. I think because we were all struggling and we were all enthusiastic about the directions we were going. So I think that in general, at the peer group level, the men were very supportive.
Now, you've chaired the department that you went to graduate school in. Looking at the graduate program now, more women than men, the most obvious change. But how much change do you see in how the graduate program, I guess, is working and how it's supporting women coming in?
Well, I'll just correct one thing you said briefly, because it's sort of an unusual situation. I was actually a student in the chemistry department, and then I became chair of the geology and geophysics department.
Oh, so you switched.
So I switched. But in terms of your question, I see a huge difference in terms of the collegiality that the students have with the scientific staff. There's a formal mentoring program now, and I see a very much more open discussion about one of the issues that Ellen Capel brought up, actually, which is this balance between life and science. And that discussion is much more openly had today.
I mean, we have now at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, you know, a committee on work-life balance and on women's issues. That's got to seem like incredible progress from when you first arrived.
It certainly does. And, you know, the progress I see in terms of the participation of students in fieldwork, in going to sea, the general collegiality within individual labs between the scientists, the postdocs, and the graduate students is a huge improvement.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with marine geochemist Susan Humphreys. You can join our conversation by calling 866-999-4626 or send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Susan Humphreys, after graduate school, you went back to your native England for a postdoc, but in very short order, just a few years, you were back in Woods Hole. Talk a little bit about coming back, because you didn't actually come back to Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. You took a bit of a different tack because you came back with your new husband, who was a scientist.
That's right. Yeah, I went back to England with every intention of staying in England and working. And two things happened. One was I had met my future husband, who was a young scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And the other thing that happened was when I got back to England, it was in the mid to late 70s. And in England at that time, funding was very, very tight. The oceanographic research vessels were laid up. There was very little money to do any research. And the other thing that had happened was in the 70s, a large number of professors, lecturers had been hired, and in England there is no tenure system. And so the possibilities of jobs opening up was relatively slim. So both of those factors figured into the decision to come back. I got married. And my husband, as I had said, was a scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. But Lamont Doherty Geological Observatory, as it was then known, in Nyack, New York, was potentially interested in hiring him. And so we went down there for just about a year. And I was a visiting scientist there while he was working. But we decided that we preferred the lifestyle in Woods Hole. And so we ended up coming back, and then I had the task of trying to find some sort of position, because obviously we were dealing with a dual career problem, which was very difficult in those days.
Was Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution not an option for you?
It was, at that time, Woods Hole tended not to hire back its own students, particularly so quickly. And so I didn't feel that was an option. I did become a visiting scientist at Woods Hole, trying to keep my own research going. But it was clear I was going to have to find something else. And as probably many listeners are aware, Woods Hole is not the most diverse place to try to find
it's another
a small position.
Town. But so you ended up at the Sea Education Association just right up the road.
I did. I got a call from them one day saying that my name had been recommended and would I go out as a visiting scientist for a leg of one of their cruises on the sailing vessel Westward. I did that. I really enjoyed it. And then they offered me a position and I ended up staying at Sea Education Association for 13 years. I was one of their scientists. So I would teach undergraduate students on shore for 6 weeks. And then we would take them to sea on the sailing research vessels for another 6 weeks. And after that, I became dean of the organization.
That gets you out to sea, one of the things that you love, but of course also a challenge in balancing work and life. But it's primarily, as you've said, education. There, especially at that time, was very little research going on at Sea Education Association. Obviously, if you stayed there for 13 years, you must have enjoyed the education. But did you miss the research?
What I tried to do was through having a visiting scientist position at Woods Hole, I tried to keep my hand in research because I was very aware of the fact that if I ever wanted to leave SEA, I would need to have some sort of publication record to demonstrate my interest in scientific research. I really loved the organization. I think the programs that they teach are excellent, and the experiential learning is really very well done, particularly now that they have much more sophisticated science equipment. But we got very motivated students. They were always fun. And living with 24 students on a 100-foot ship for 6 weeks, you certainly get to know every one of them.
What you're describing, I hear a couple of very contemporary issues there. And the first is what scientists like to jokingly call the two-body problem. Physicists and mathematicians will get the joke there. But basically this idea of a dual career couple, both struggling to find jobs in science. If anything, that has become a more and more common and perhaps, again, like the work balance, work-life balance issues, something that's much more openly recognized and handled today than it was when you were dealing with it.
I think that's true. And certainly if you look around Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution today, you find many scientists who are married couples who are both working within the institution. And I think it is a problem that is openly discussed, during the consideration of an applicant for a position in terms of how the institution might be able to help. So it's much more open, and I think it's dealt with much more proactively than in those days when it was really up to the individuals to try to sort the problem out.
As you mentioned, many institutions, not just here in Woods Hole, now have written or unwritten policies about spousal hires and, perhaps giving consideration to the spouse of a scientist if there's a job opening, that sort of thing. Do you see those policies as a good thing or perhaps kind of maybe a necessary evil, not necessarily the way we'd like to do things, but something that we kind of need to do to get to a more equitable position?
I consider them a good thing. I think that it certainly helps with the equity issue. I think it's very important in places such as Woods Hole, where it is relatively isolated from other universities, other types of academic or industry careers that a scientist, qualified scientist, might be able to pursue. So I consider it a positive.
The other issue that I hear when you're talking about this point in your career is a lot of women worry that if they leave science, whether it's for a non-research job for a period of time, perhaps while they're raising children, or completely just staying at home with children, that they'll never be able to get back in. You did work your way back in from an education, primarily educational position, into a senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. So how did you do that?
Well, it was somewhat complicated. When I after 13 years at SEA, and I decided I really wanted to move on, not because I didn't like SEA, I'm actually still chair of their board of trustees, I was fortunate in that a position opened up at Woods Hole Oceanographic to run a major NSF program, which was called RIDGE, which was a program devoted to studies of the mid-ocean ridge system. And they needed a coordinator to run that program. And so what I did was I ended up applying for that and came back to the Oceanographic Institution in a technical and administrative role. And I used those 3 years that position was good for, plus another three where I was running the science committee for the ocean drilling program. I used those years to build up my research portfolio and my funding for research so that by the time those administrative positions ended, I had built up enough research and enough publications for me to continue on. And in 1998, I was appointed a senior scientist.
How do you build up your research when you have a full-time administrative job? This isn't necessarily like, writing late at night after you've finished your day job. How do you do that?
Well, it's a combination of, there is some work after you finish your day job, and there's work at weekends. Basically, what I did was I wrote a number of proposals to try to get my research funded, and I slowly built that up. My position when I was on the science committee for the drilling program was only paid 6 months of my salary, so I was able to use the other 6 months to really develop my research.
That's marine geochemist Susan Humphreys. I'm Heather Goldstone. Our conversation continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking today with marine geochemist Susan Humphreys of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. She was one of just two women in her department during graduate school, but she has since gone on to chair another department at the institution and most recently led the overhaul and upgrade of the submersible Alvin. Susan Humphreys, you have spent literally, by your calculations, years of your life at sea, both with Sea Education Association and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. There have been a number of articles that I've seen in the past few years, women telling stories of sexual harassment while out in the field. I don't think I've actually seen any regarding going to sea, but you have said that you faced an openly hostile environment. We heard Ellen Capel earlier talking about the fact that life on board a ship can be a difficult place for a woman. How much of a deterrent was that for you?
Well, I don't actually think it was a deterrent because I really love going to sea. And so, you know, I was willing to deal with the situation that I would have to, I should say right up front, has significantly improved over time. When I first started going to sea, there was, the hostility was mostly from some of the older crew members who had the superstition that having a woman on a ship was unlucky.
Really?
Absolutely. And, you know, they really did not like it. Some of them would not talk to you at all. And so it was that sort of feeling. The younger crew members, of course, many of them thought it was great to have some women at sea. But as time has gone on and as more women are going out to sea, I think that clearly the situation has significantly improved.
You have also spent a lot of time going to the bottom of the ocean in Alvin. There's a photo of you that crops up in a couple of your personal profiles and I've seen around where you're sitting in Alvin looking out the window. And you don't have like a huge smile on your face or anything, but you look incredibly content and peaceful as you're looking out that window, as I think the caption says, something about the last sunlight you'll see for 8 or 12 hours as you go to the bottom of the ocean. What do you love about being in Alvin and going deep into the ocean?
I think the thing that I love the most is the fact that you never know what you're going to see. So every dive you do is a real dive of exploration. Once you get to the bottom, you're just so incredibly busy because you're not just making observations, you're taking samples, you're putting equipment on the seafloor, not only for yourself, but for other people. So you always have a long, long list of tasks you have to accomplish. So you become very, very focused. And I think that, you know, just the sheer idea that you might be seeing something that nobody has ever seen before just makes every dive so exciting.
Being under miles of water doesn't bother you?
I don't really think about it that much. You know, it's a long commute to work. It takes about an hour and a half to 2 hours to get to the bottom and the same to get home. But it's just so fascinating when you're down there.
As someone who has spent that much time in Alvin, while serving as vice president for marine operations, marine facilities and operations for Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, you led the 50th anniversary complete overhaul. I mean, this is complete disassembly and recreation of the submersible Alvin. That must have been an incredible opportunity for you. That must have been so exciting.
It was very exciting, but it was probably one of the most challenging things that I have done in my career.
Why?
Well, here I am, a scientist who certainly uses the Alvin, but without the engineering knowledge of such a complicated piece of equipment. I actually inherited the project from the previous vice president, and then I ended up staying with it till the end, way beyond the time I was interim vice president. But I was working with a group of very dedicated engineers. I was on a very steep learning curve in terms of the engineering, the technology, and even the project management, because being such a large project, there were certain requirements for managing the project that were important and that I had to learn. And I'll tell you, one of the most challenging things was keeping that project on budget and trying to keep it on schedule, which didn't actually happen, but just keeping it moving forward all the time and facing one challenge after another.
The docs in general and the Alvin team as well have got to be some of the most male-dominated parts of the institution. I mean, of the Alvin pilots, there have been, what, 39, and one of them has been a woman, Cindy Vandover. Coming in, as you said, as someone who came from a scientific background, was not an engineer, was not a manager, and now one of the only women in the whole project, did you face any pushback? Did you feel like there was any sense from those under you that maybe you know, you weren't the right, was that part of the challenge, that perhaps there was some question about whether or not you were the right person to be there?
I didn't feel that. I'm pleased to say there were a couple of young women engineers who played a major role in that upgrade, which was extremely good to see, and I think was a great experience for them. I certainly, because I inherited the project, I felt a little bit awkward at the beginning because I didn't really feel I had the skill set necessary to do the job, but I knew it had to get done, and so you just learn those things. There's always pushback to the person who's in charge, and certainly that was true, but I certainly at no point felt it was because I was a woman.
Well, that's very encouraging to hear. At the same time that that was going on, you were also leading efforts to draw the scientific community into an ocean drilling program. As you've already mentioned, not your first foray into administration with ocean drilling, but let's talk about this program. What was the goal of what you were doing?
The ocean drilling program that was ongoing ended its life, and so there was a need, if we were going to continue with a facility that could do ocean drilling for science, there was a need for the community to come together and explain the reasons why and essentially lobby the National Science Foundation to renew the program. And the ocean drilling program has been so important to the community for a long time.
Why is that? What is the importance, the goal? What does it provide?
Basically, what it provides is it provides a way to get long-term records of the history of the ocean, the history of climate. It actually was the main reason that the field of paleoceanography, which is looking at circulation of the oceans in the past, came into being. And it's also one of the only ways to get samples of the Earth's crust from below the surface. It's been responsible for a lot of excellent mentoring of graduate students who've participated in the program, a lot of publications. And so I led a team of four scientists that basically tried to bring the community together to lay out the case for a new ocean drilling program.
Now, as I mentioned with Ellen Capel, this is one of the things that this recent issue of the journal Oceanography found, that perhaps within ocean drilling is a place where we're seeing significant improvements in equity and opportunity for women in oceanography. In your experience, what is that situation like right now? And perhaps why would that be an area of more equity?
I think that one of the reasons is that the ocean drilling program makes an effort to take out postdocs and graduate students as part of the scientific party. And so there are a lot of opportunities. There's three expeditions a year on the U.S. drilling vessel. There's one on the European and one or fewer on the Japanese vessels. And those provide great opportunities for students to go to sea, get experience, participate in a big international shipboard scientific party. And so it's a relatively popular way of students gaining experience. And I think if you look at the statistics, you'll find that most of the women, or many of the women, are those who are in graduate school and in the postdoc level. As Ellen Capel said, at the chief scientist level, you find far fewer, and that is a reflection of there being far fewer senior women in oceanography.
In addition, as you've mentioned, this is a two-month cruise. That's huge from the perspective of if you have a family and childcare, or for that matter, elderly parents that you're caring for. That's a really hard thing to navigate. And obviously female scientists and men as well manage this for 2, 3, even 6 week cruises. But 2 months is really a long time. Do you think, as we've seen progress towards addressing things like two career families and work-life balance and other issues that seem to disproportionately affect women in their careers become more openly addressed, that maybe things like childcare or family care, finding ways to help female scientists negotiate that, could become a more open part of helping get women to sea on some of these longer cruises?
I think it could, but I also think I see a change over the years in terms of the sharing of responsibilities for either childcare or for taking care of elder parents. There's much more sharing of responsibilities today that I'm seeing that I didn't see back when I was a student. So which I think is a really positive move forward. So I think that is certainly helping the situation.
You recently were awarded a fellowship in the American Geophysical Union. A wonderful award. Congratulations.
Thank you.
The issue of oceanography, looking at women in science, looked at specifically the American Geophysical Union. It's been part of a program since 2009 to evaluate its own practices with regard to gender equity. And the statistics there were really interesting because as of 2014, the number of women who were made fellows pretty much matches the number of the percentage of women who are members. You were awarded your fellowship at around the average age, male or female, for that award. But what really jumped out at me was that as of 2012, 2013, only 10 to 15% of the nominations came from women. Why do you think women aren't speaking up and being a proactive part of the awards process?
That's an interesting question, and I don't know that I know the answer. I am aware that very often the networks of individuals who nominate people tend to be networks mostly of men. More recently, there have been more efforts on women's parts to actually nominate some women as well. But, you know, in my case, I know I was nominated and the supporting letters were all from men. So, you know, it's a difficult question to answer.
Now, you've testified before Congress. I wonder how you see that as part of your career, your perhaps responsibilities as a scientist.
Well, I think that all scientists have a responsibility to do some sort of community service, if you will. In testifying to Congress, I mean, clearly there are issues in our science. There's issues with funding. There's issues about the types of science, the fields that we feel are really important to study. And we need to get that message across. And so I feel it's very important that scientists participate in addressing Congress, in talking with their senators, congressional staff members about the science and about the importance of funding and the importance of basic research in moving the science forward.
With just a couple minutes left here, I wonder what advice you offer to women entering the field of oceanography.
The advice I think I would give them is if you enjoy it, you know, try everything. Really explore everything. Work hard to develop collegial relationships with the people in your lab and particularly with your peers because they're the cohort of people that you'll be moving through your career with. And close relationships develop in terms of collaborations with research and just keep moving forward and you'll do great.
What about to the men coming in? What perhaps is the one thing that you would offer that they could do to help promote a more equitable field of science?
I think the one thing would be to involve the female scientists in the activities that the male scientists do as a network and really include...
You mean the professional activities or social activities?
Both. Hmm. I think it's very important to develop that network, and I think it needs to be inclusive of both men and women.
Susan Humphries is a senior scientist in the Department of Geology and Geophysics at Woodtull Oceanographic Institution. She has chaired that department, served as vice president of marine facilities and operations for the institution. Susan Humphries, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw through the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Living Lab is a production of WCAI, the local NPR station for the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands.